I'm Alina Selganikoff, Vice President and Director of Women's Health Policy here at the Foundation. It is a great pleasure to welcome you here this morning to the Barbara Jordan Health Center, Conference Center. You may not know, but Barbara Jordan was an esteemed and now revered member of the Kaiser Family Foundation Board, and I think it is extremely fitting that we're holding this event here today in the center that's named after Barbara Jordan. It's an extremely opportune time to be meeting here today. Yesterday, the White House had a meeting on health disparities, and on Friday, they had a forum on women and health reform. So clearly, it's the priority of this administration and the Congress to improve access to coverage and affordability of care to millions of people in this country. We also know that women use the health care differently than men, which is an area issue that spans their entire lives from their reproductive years through their senior years. They also play a central role managing the health of their families. We also have a broadened and more nuanced understanding of the scope of the historical problem that we have had in this nation with health inequities, much of it falling on the shoulders of women. And so while the nation is weighing and watching on the federal role of health reform, we also know that state policies play a critical role in the health and well-being of their residents, both today and in the future. So we felt that to make sound policy choices, that it is really important for policymakers to understand the scope of the challenges that their residents face and to see how different populations fare in their states. But as many of you know, this is easier said than done. There are actually very few data sources that really allow us to understand the health and healthcare patterns of populations in the states, and particularly populations of color that may be much smaller share of the states. And that was a big part of our motivation to look at to do this study. Now, when we actually started working on this study, which seems like eons ago, it was a very different climate. We really didn't suspect that health reform was going to be facing us as quickly as it has and to be such a central issue. But we did recognize that there was a central role for the states to play and the federal government in order to eliminate these longstanding disparities and inequities. Really, and maybe to think about reaching even beyond the healthcare system to find strategies to eliminate the large chasm that you will hear about today and ultimately to raise the health and well-being of all women in the nation. Before we get started with the program, I would like to make a few thank yous and acknowledgments. First of all, to acknowledge the study team led by Kara James. Dr. James is the lead author on this study. She is also the director of the Barbara Jordan Health Policy Scholars Program and here at the Foundation, and as a senior policy analyst in our race, ethnicity, and healthcare program here at the Foundation. Also, Marsha Lilly Blanton, who is a senior advisor here at the Foundation, Megan Thomas, and Usha Ranji, and a special acknowledgement to Roberta Wynn, who is our co-author from UCLA, who has worked with us on many projects here at the Foundation. I'd also like to acknowledge Randy Zuwalik, who is now with ICF Macro, who had the unenviable task of overseeing the incredibly complex programming for this study, and to Jane Ahn, who is a former Kaiser intern who prepared all the fact sheets that you see and you can access on the website, and to Lindsay Donaldson, who really did yeoman's work getting all this data up on the State Health Facts website. I'd also like to thank our advisory committee, particularly Dr. Carolyn Clancy, who's here with us today, and Chloe Bird, who provided a painstaking review of this report that you have in front of you. There's a lot of material in your folder that I'd like to draw your attention to. We have fact sheets. You'll see three of them there for the local area of D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. But up on our website, we have 51 fact sheets available for every state in the nation and the district. In addition to that, all of this information is posted in a special section of the State Health Facts website that the Foundation also sponsors, so that you can sort and search and map to your heart's content and also download the data for other research. We have a great morning prepared for you, and I'm sure we're going to have the opportunity to discuss a lot of different aspects of the analysis. The way we're going to start off the day, Kara James is going to present the key findings of the study. Then we're going to have the opportunity to view the debut of a video documentary that Jackie Judd and her team has prepared for us here at the Foundation. It's called Women at Risk, A View from the Safety Net, which was filmed here locally at the Arlington Free Clinic one morning. So you'll get a chance to hear the voices of the women themselves in terms of their own experiences about their health and health care. And then we're extremely fortunate to have a panel of experts on women's health, on healthcare disparities, to help us put all this information in context. Starting with Beth Beck, who is the executive director of the Capital Breast Care Center here in Southeast DC. Their bios are in the packet, so I'm just going to talk about, name them and their affiliations, but they have an incredibly rich experience. Next to Beth is Dr. Carolyn Clancy. She's the director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and as I mentioned, one of our esteemed advisory committee members and really a national leader both in women's health and in healthcare disparities. Next is Peter Katusian. Mr. Katusian represents the 10th Middlesex District in the Massachusetts State House. He chairs the Joint Committee on Financial Services. He has also spearheaded numerous initiatives to improve access and reduce health disparities in Massachusetts. And at the end of the table is Dr. Cynthia Lindquist-Mala, president of the Chandeska Sikana, which means Little Hoop, Community College, that serves the Spirit Lake Dakota community in North Dakota, and she is also a member of the National Advisory Committee of the Foundation's Barbara Jordan Health Policy Scholars Program. After the discussion, we're going to have a short wrap-up by Marcia Lilly Blanton, one of our co-authors, and currently serving as a senior advisor to the Foundation. So now I'm going to turn it over to Kara. Thank you.
Thank you, Alina. And thank you all for joining us here today. As Alina said, we're going to go through some of the key findings of the report. There are a lot of data in this report, and you can definitely spend, we could have a whole session just on going through the report, but we're not. Just to sort of set the stage here as we're looking, and this is not new to anyone, we're talking about a population that we have about one-third of the population in the U.S. self-identifies as a racial or ethnic minority. And when we talk about people of color, that population is growing, and we will see that by about 2050, at least half of the population of the U.S. will be a person of color. But it's worth noting in this pie chart that we're looking at separate groups. When we say women of color or people of color, we mean those who are African American or Black, Hispanic or Latino, Asian American, American Indian, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander, or those who are two or more races. But looking at data at the aggregate level really masks what's happening at the state level. And we see that there are differential patterns across the U.S. so that this population distribution that you see here, the reflective of the national average, is not reflective of what's going on in each state. And this map shows you how the states vary in terms of the population that is represented of people of color. And we have several states that are already what we consider majority-minority states, including California, Hawaii, the District of Columbia, New Mexico, and Texas. And you see that the range of these states in terms of their population of color ranges from a very high of 25% of the population who is white in Hawaii, or 75% who is a person of color, compared to 96% of the population is white in Maine, or 4% of the population as a person of color. So as Alina said, we really wanted to look at how these experiences vary across each state for women of color, specifically in terms of their health and access to care. So moving into the data specifically and what we've done, we've looked at indicators that are relevant to women's health. We needed data that actually provided a sample size that was large enough that we could make reliable estimates. We looked for indicators that had relevant policy and programming relevance, as well as those from reliable data sources and that allowed for comparability across states. We used primarily 25 indicators in this report that were reported by race and ethnicity, and an additional 8 at the state level that reflect some of the policies that are happening there. Our primary data source was the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System from the CDC, and that accounted for 13 indicators primarily in our health status dimension. We had another 6 come from the current population survey, largely looking at some of those social determinants issues as well as our coverage. We also included data from the National Vital Statistics System, the Area Resource File, and other sources where we looked to really highlight some of those indicators that we thought really were critical to women's health and not included in the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System or the current population survey. And I'll talk about a couple of those in a minute. But some of those data sources included the National Cancer Institute's SEER data, the CDC's HIV Surveillance System, and we would like to thank SAMHSA for their special run of our data for serious psychological distress. To look specifically, we included in here, I've already kind of alluded to it, three dimensions that we had our indicators. The first one was health status. This included 11 indicators: fair or poor health, unhealthy days, limited activities, the prevalence of diabetes, the prevalence of heart disease, obesity rates, smoking rates, cancer mortality, new AIDS cases. This is not HIV, but this is actually new AIDS cases, low birth weight, and serious psychological distress, which is a scale that uses six questions related to psychological distress in the past 30 days, although with this particular indicator, we're measuring the past 30 days of the month that was the worst in the year. So whereas other national data sets that use this really just focus on the past 30 days, ours is over the course of the year. We also included data in health access and utilization that includes no health coverage, no personal doctor, not having had a checkup in the past 2 years, not having had a dental visit, not having had a doctor visit because of cost, for women who are over the age of 40 to 64, not having had a mammogram in the past 2 years, no pap smear, and late or no prenatal care. And finally, we also felt it was important to include some of those barriers that those variables that affect access to care, as well as the health outcomes, which we consider the social determinants. And some of those include the prevalence of poverty, the median household income, the gender wage gap, and this is the comparison between the women of the specific racial ethnic group to white males who are full-time year-round workers. We have the prevalence of no high school diploma, women who are living in a single-parent household that is headed by a female with children, and residential segregation, which measures how isolated the neighborhoods and communities are. As I mentioned already, we also included 8 policy variables looking at the state level. Obviously, because these are effective of all women in the state, we could not do disparity scores for these. But we included a measure of the physician diversity ratio, measuring how diverse the physician population is compared to the population of the state in which they are serving. The primary care health profession shortage area, how many people are living in a county in which there is no provider aggregated up to the state. Same with mental health. A comparison of the Medicaid to Medicare fee index, looking both at or specifically at primary care services, obstetrical care, and other services. We also included Medicaid income eligibility for both working parents and pregnant women, family planning funding for women in need or low-income women, and a measure of abortion access, which was a composite of 3 indicators that included a mandatory waiting period for abortion, whether or not Medicaid allows funding to be used for abortion, and the percent of women living in counties with no abortion provider. What is new for this report compared to some of the others that we've seen is that we created a disparity score to compare what's going on between women of color and white women in each state. This disparity score is essentially the ratio, if we were to take diabetes as an example, the prevalence of diabetes among women of color divided by the prevalence of diabetes among white women. So that a disparity score greater than 1 means that minority women are faring worse than white women. A disparity score equal to 1 means that we have parity or that they're doing the same. And a disparity score less than 1 means that minority women are actually doing better than white women. In addition to this disparity score, which we created for each of the 25 indicators that I listed before, we wanted to aggregate up to a dimension level to sum up what can we say about the overall health status for women of color in a given state. And to do this, we created what we called a dimension score. And this is essentially the average of all of those disparity scores that I've just mentioned, but we wanted to take into account states' performance relative to the other states, so that a state with low disparities might, if they have low disparities because the health status of all women is poor, we don't necessarily want them to be rated high. And so we adjusted for that by multiplying these disparity scores by the ratio of white women in the state to the national average for white women. And then we statistically tested to see where the states fell into three categories: better than average, average, or worse than average. And it's worth pointing out that better than average, average, and worse than average are the average disparity score. So better than average does not mean you don't have disparities. It just means you're doing better than the national average. There's a lot of data in this report, but we really are just going to highlight the key findings here. The first being that this is not a surprise, I think, to anyone in this room. Disparities were evident in every state and on most indicators. And to take a few of those indicators specifically, what we found was that when you look at new AIDS cases, that the new AIDS case rate for women of color was more than 11 times that of white women, or 26.4 per 100,000 compared to 2.3. It's also worth noting, as people are sort of jaw-dropping, reflecting on this, this is the largest disparity score that we had in our report. And it was consistent across the board for most states, but the range was variable. And it is worth noting that this disparity score was on average three and a half times higher than any other disparity score for any other indicator in the report. Within health status and access, we also saw that uninsured rates for women of color varied and were more than twice that for white women, so overall 28% compared to 13%. In the social determinants, we saw that the rate of no high school diploma was more than three times higher for women of color than for white women, or 23% to 7%. But we also found, since we were looking at this report for all women of all races, that we found challenges among white women. And we saw that rates of smoking, overall cancer mortality, serious psychological distress, and no routine checkup were lower among women of color than they were for white women. So in short, white women were having more challenges in these areas than women of color. But again, this is a state-level report, so it is important to look and see how these indicators vary by state. And here is just a sample of, as you see, that the average disparity score that I mentioned for AIDS, is, for example, was an 11.58, the rate 11.5 times higher for women of color than for white women. But that ranged from a very high of 37, basically, in Minnesota to essentially zero. And that basically meant in Montana that there were no new AIDS cases reported in that year for any women of color. For no health coverage, you see that the range was a 0.92 in Hawaii all the way up to a 4.6 in North Dakota. No high school diploma, though the national average was a 3.11, it ranged from a 0.82 in New Hampshire all the way up to an 11.7 or 8 in the District of Columbia. Smoking rates is one of the indicators I pointed out that women of color actually did better than white women, and the national average for that was a 0.59, ranging from a very low down in 0.39 in Florida all the way up to 1.98 in South Dakota. And finally, with cancer mortality, you can see it was 0.86 with a range of 0.6 to 2.14. I'd like to just point out as we're looking at this that you can see that the disparity scores for indicators varied, and they were not all the case that we had those where the disparity score was a 3 or a 2, but there was a substantial range even within each indicator across the report, indicating that we have different challenges with regards to specific indicators. To sort of look a little bit more at the scope of the problem, we see that no state achieved parity or had disparities favoring women of color on more than 8 indicators. So that's 8 out of 25. The best state had 7 in which women of color were doing better or the same as white women. Women of color achieved parity on no indicators in South Dakota and only one indicator in North Dakota. And we can talk a little bit more about some of the challenges in those particular states. All states had at least one indicator in which the rate of women for women of color was more than twice that for white women. And finally, in Connecticut, the District of Columbia, New Jersey, North Dakota, and South Dakota, the rate for women of color was more than double that of white women on at least 10 indicators. Another finding of this report is that small disparities are sometimes the result of both white women and women of color doing poorly. And the best way to highlight this is through one of the figures that you're going to see throughout the report that's going to take some time to go through, but is a 2x2 graph. And I'm going to step you through the very complicated, people are laughing at this, just to show you. So this axis here, the y-axis, is the disparity score. As the disparity score increases, starting at the bottom of which those numbers were anything below this line, which is a disparity score of 1, anything below that line indicates that minority women are doing better than white women. Anything above that line indicates that minority women are doing worse than white women. On this axis, we have the prevalence of the indicator for white women. And again, we have the national average, and in this case, we're looking at cardiovascular disease. So anything to the left of the national average indicates that white women in that state are doing better than the national average, and anything to the right of that line indicates that white women are doing worse than the national average. So this creates four quadrants. This first quadrant is where we see disparity scores are higher than the national, or than women of color are doing worse than white women, and white women in the state are doing better than the national average. This second quadrant means women of color in the state are doing worse than white women, and white women in the state are doing worse than the national average. The third quadrant, we have women of color doing better than white women in the state, and white women in the state doing worse than the national average. And finally, this fourth quadrant is women of color doing better than than white women, and white women in the state doing better than the national average. So to bring this all back to the point of small disparities are sometimes the result of both white women and women of color doing poorly, we want to look at West Virginia. And in West Virginia, you can see that the disparities are very close to parity for that state, but white women in West Virginia have the highest prevalence rate of cardiovascular disease of all women in the country, all white women in the country. So those disparity scores are not necessarily reflective of good health for any of the women in the state. Another finding is that each racial and ethnic group faced its own particular set of challenges with regards to health and health care. And one of the biggest findings for this report is the problems that we saw faced by American Indian and Alaska Native women. And this was a bit of a surprise, I think, to us, in part because for many data sets, we don't often have the ability to parse out Native American women or other smaller populations such as the Asian American or the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander. And so to be able to do this and to document the disparities that we saw among this population was really, I think, a bit of a surprise for us. But outcomes for American Indian and Alaska Native women were among the worst on nearly all indicators in this report. With regards to health status, smoking rates, you can see that more than a third of women who are American Indian or Alaska Native were current smokers compared to a quarter of those who were white. Serious psychological distress, a measure in which overall minority women had lower rates than white women, you see that more than a quarter of American Indian and Alaska Native women would be qualified for serious psychological distress compared to white women. And it's worth pointing out on this serious psychological distress, this does not mean diagnosed. This is people who qualify for it based on a self-response, and we don't know whether or not they're actually getting care, but we do know from some of the data that SAMHSA has looked at that there are lower rates of those who get care who are in serious psychological distress for communities of color than for whites. When we look at access and utilization for no recent mammogram, again, more than a third of American Indian Alaska Native women have not had a recent mammogram compared to a quarter of white women. And again, 3 in 10 American Indian Alaska Native women have had late or no prenatal care compared to 11% of white women. With the social determinants, a third of American Indian Alaska Native women live in poverty compared to 12% of white, and the high school graduation rate is almost triple that for American women compared to white women. But we also saw challenges within other groups. Hispanic women consistently had hot problems with regards to access and utilization of care. African American women or black women had among the worst rates for many health and social determinants indicators, kind of trading off with the Native American women when they were second worst or so. Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and other Pacific Islander women had lower rates of preventive screenings, specifically with regards to mammogram and pap smear. And again, white women had higher rates of smoking, cancer mortality, psychological distress, and no routine care. Another thing is that within these indicators, we saw variation across states within racial and ethnic group. And this chart indicates, just an example, for each group, some of the range that we see with regards to outcomes. So for American Indian and Alaska Native women among diabetes, the range is 3.5 in Alaska up to a 13.5 in South Dakota. Obesity among Hispanic women is 9.9 in the district compared to 33.8 in Wisconsin. No doctor visit due to cost for black women ranges from 13.4 in Massachusetts to 33.4 in Texas. Asian American and Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander women had rates of late or no prenatal care that ranged from a 9.7 in Ohio to 34.3 in Utah. And smoking rates among white women ranged from a 10.2 in Utah to a 33.1 in West Virginia. So again, as I mentioned earlier, we wanted to aggregate this up to the dimension level to say what can we say about the states at each of the dimensions. And the first thing is that few states had consistent scores across all three dimensions. And so this map shows you how states fared, summary of cross, better of average for all dimensions. So the states in white were better than average on no dimensions. And the states in the sort of lighter blue, better than average on one dimension, so forth and so on, so that we get to four states which were better than average on all three dimensions, being Maryland, Virginia, Georgia, and Hawaii. When we look at the states, and again, just pointing out, better than average does not mean no disparities. It just means you're doing better than the national average. Looking at those that are worse than average, again, same pattern that those in white were worse than average on no dimensions, and the darkest states were worse than average on three dimensions. And you can see sort of a little bit of regional patterning that those in the South Central, being Louisiana, Arkansas, and Mississippi, were worse than average on all three, but again, our plain states of North Dakota, South Dakota, and Montana, as well as Indiana, were worse than average on all three dimensions. And some of their surrounding states were worse than average on two dimensions. Finally, small disparities in one dimension do not necessarily correspond to small disparities in another dimension. And this gets to some of our, what do we make of all this? And I think, you know, we're not going to be able to make a lot. We'll have to do some more work. But you can see that the District of Columbia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania were better than average on access, but worse than average on health status and the social determinants. Texas and Arizona were better than average on health status and worse than average on access and social determinants. And Oklahoma was worse than average on health status and access and better than average on the social determinants. So what does all of this mean, and what are the implications for the work that we found? I think the implications can be classified into sort of three groups broadly: women's health, health disparities, and what this means for the delivery system. Overall, in women's health, across the board, we saw consistent challenges for all women. And if you looked at the rates of mammogram and pap smears and things like that, you see that we still have, regardless of race, a quarter of all women who have not had a mammogram in the past 2 years. This despite efforts at the national and state level to encourage and increase rates of mammogram screening for women, particularly women of color. Poverty. 1 in 6 women live in poverty in the country. And this is something that has broad implications for their health outcomes, their ability to care for their family, and the resources that's available to them. With regards to health disparities, all racial and ethnic populations face challenges, but some at a considerably higher rate than others. So we've highlighted the challenges faced by Native American women. Although the variation within these indicators indicates that we have a long way to go for some indicators and less far to go for others in terms of closing the gap. There are implications for the delivery system, access to care, coverage. As I mentioned, we still have nearly 17% overall of women who are without health coverage, and access to care is implicated in some of the policy indicators that we looked at when we talk about the health profession shortage area. Nearly 4 in 10 women throughout the country are living in a health profession, a primary care health profession shortage area, or a mental health care professional shortage area. And again, looking at the implications of the social determinants for people's ability to navigate through the system, as well as access care and the care that's available to them. So we see that the health policies throughout the country and in the states in particular help shape access to outcomes, access to care, and health outcomes, be it through coverage availability with regards to Medicaid eligibility or other sort of payment and financing issues. As we look forward, though, we're clearly having this conversation within the backdrop of larger health reform conversations. The health reform conversations that are taking place relate largely to coverage, cost reductions, and improvements in quality. And I'm sure, as Dr. Clancy is going to mention, when we talk about the National Healthcare Disparities Report or the National Quality Disparities Report, we're seeing slight improvements in quality overall within the country. But that doesn't necessarily mean that a rising tide is lifting all boats. When we look at disparities overall, disparities are not improving or are actually worsening for quite a few indicators. We also have the impact of the economic crisis and the impact of an ability of a state to direct resources to addressing these challenges. But also, as states become constrained due to the budget cuts that they're experiencing, they may be making choices to cut programs or cut services that can have a disproportionate effect on both disparities and the population of women at large. Other thing is, too, the availability of data. As you go through the report, you're going to notice that we still have, unfortunately, quite a few gaps where we are unable to report for specific racial and ethnic populations in a given state. This despite merging 3 years of data, or in some cases 4 years of data, to actually indicate what's happening. There is also a lack of data for some indicators that I'm sure each of you could come up with that you thought would be important to include in this report that are indicators of women's health. But if it was not available at the state level and not available by race or ethnicity, it was very difficult for us to include that in this report. So there are still data challenges that we need to address with regards to both disparities and women's health overall. And finally, there are implications for the state and the federal level with regards to responsibility as to how we go about addressing these issues. In the states, again, we talked about Medicaid eligibility rules and where that plays out, the availability of providers and things like that, but also the federal government to help some of those states who may be really struggling to address some of these issues. We have states that are really ahead of the game in some respects in terms of addressing these issues and others that have not quite gotten there, and it may be due to resources or other issues, political will, whatever. But those are things that we will need to look forward to addressing in order to really make progress on the elimination of disparities and the improvement of health for women overall. So with that, I'd like to turn to our video, which really does put a face on the many numbers that we have in this report. We are extremely grateful to Nancy Pellison, Paula Potts, and Martha Ware for opening their doors to us at the Arlington Free Clinic so that we could tell the stories of the women that you see in this video. And we are also extremely grateful to the women of the clinic for sharing their stories with us so that we can highlight some of the challenges that they experience and how we can address these issues. While this is a video that reflects the experiences of women in one clinic, these are stories that are not unique to women around the country. They would be echoed by women around the country, regardless of race or ethnicity. And now, without further ado, we present Women at Risk, a view from the safety net.
Even before the doors open, women line the hall outside the Arlington Free Clinic in Virginia. Women without health insurance, public or private, come here for care. They arrive early because those at the back of the line may be told to come back another day.
How are you?
Without the free clinic, our patients who can't afford to purchase health care in traditional ways have really no place to go. There is an emergency room at our local hospital, which does wonderful work, but it's just a place to go for a situation.
Were there times when you were sick that you just didn't see a doctor?
When I have money, I have to see the doctor. If I don't have money, I don't see the doctor because it's expensive.
No.
Magali Zapata, an unemployed babysitter, has high cholesterol and other chronic health problems. She has never had health insurance. It costs her $80 just to get in the door of a doctor's office, an impossible sum for Zapata.
Now I don't have any lot of job. I can't find a job. It's too hard this time to find with this economic situation. It's too hard to find a job. I'm not working at this time.
I've had so many women tell me they've lost their jobs. A lot of our women they clean houses, they clean offices. And, you know, I think everybody has had a little bit of it, has noticed the economic ripple in the last year in one way or another.
The barriers to health care so many poor women face, whether American-born or immigrants, are numerous and complex. Past experiences, discrimination, cultural backgrounds, knowledge about health care, family situations, and more.
Health care for our women is a great challenge because of the social conditions that in which they live. It's very difficult. They have young children or teenage children to support, and we all know the circumstances of what that involves with children and the complications there. But because they're the breadwinner, they don't have easy access to getting to a job. They can't just walk out of the job and say, I'm going for a medical appointment.
I want you to start keeping a calendar.
Add to that list the sheer complexity of the country's healthcare system. When Orna Camacho arrived from Mongolia, just figuring out how to see a doctor was a mystery.
If I were in my country, it's easy to get to see a doctor. It's not expensive. And here is it's like a headache where I go to which hospital or if I call the emergency and how much I'm going to pay. It's really hard to get health care. Yes.
Dr. Nirmala LeMay, an OBGYN, has volunteered here since the clinic opened 15 years ago. The challenges she sees are as diverse as the clients themselves.
They're migratory type of population. Sometimes the husband has to bring them. So they don't have transport on their own. And they have to take buses, this, that. If they have young children, they put children as prioritizing rather than their own health.
I never check in my life.
Marlene Alvarez came to the Arlington Free Clinic a few years ago to bring a friend, but she was persuaded to get a checkup too. It was discovered she had late-stage breast cancer, and the financial drain on her family, including three young children, was her first thought.
We ordered the prescription and said, wow, the pharmacist said, wow, are you sure you have insurance? No. You know, six bills, $1,000. And what my reaction? I start to cry immediately, say, wow. And I feel so guilty for my kids, you know, not for myself.
The difficulties Alvarez faced went beyond the cost, the chemo, the mastectomy. It went to the heart of her ability to be understood and to understand the people trying to save her life.
This is the very hard part. Still now. So sometimes I get interpreters. Sometimes I have to figure out what's going to, I have to explain very careful, and the doctor explain me very well what they try to do to say. It's not kind of too easy. You should be, you know, understand very well what's going to be happening, what's going to be the side effect with the medicine, and what will be with your treatment. So it's not easy.
I remember Alvarez now returns to the clinic as a volunteer teacher. She leads sessions on breast self-exams. For many women here, her lessons are the first they have ever had in prevention.
If they had a problem, they all were ready to come. But if we say this you need so you can prevent, to prevent a disease is a big concept that has to be accepted by all over the world.
You can go about your life perfectly well without those kind of things. So those are clearly on the back burner, but, you know, if you wait too long, it's just such a horrible waste. And in this country, that shouldn't happen.
By the time this day ends, 17 women will have been screened, examined, given medications, and encouraged to come back. If the complexity of their lives allow, they will return. Others won't be seen again. Invisible women here and across the country who face so many obstacles to getting health care.
I would like to add my thanks to the women of the Arlington Free Clinic, the three who are here with us this morning, and also the women who were patients and shared their stories with us and were generous with their time. So thank you. Beth Beck, I would like to start the conversation with you. You head a breast cancer clinic, and your clientele is very different than the women we saw at the Arlington Free Clinic. What rings true about their experiences, and what may be different with the women you see and serve?
Well, I just want to commend. I think that was a fantastic video, and many of the stories that I think that were seen at Arlington Free Clinic are the same stories that we see at Capital Breast Care Center. Except for us, the majority of our women that are coming in actually live in the community. So we're located in Southeast D.C., right off of Pennsylvania Avenue. And so the majority of the women that come into us are in wards 7 and 8. And if you know anything about D.C., and you know anything about health disparities in D.C., you know that those are the primary wards where they tend to be economically underserved, and historically there has been very few primary care providers. So for us, we have become almost the initiation point for a woman who's accessing health care for the first time in many, many years. The majority of our women that are coming in have not had a mammogram within the last 2, some cases 5 years, and they have a number of different health concerns, whether it be out-of-control diabetes, high blood pressure that's not been checked. And so for us, we have to find a way to really navigate them through what is a fragmented and complicated health system when you have no insurance or you have just enough insurance to get you through. But then if you reach that next step where you need to see a specialist, then your options become very limited.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to turn now to a discussion of the report kind of at large. And Carolyn Clancy, as Kara mentioned, this is a unique report. What will its value be to researchers such as yourself, to lawmakers such as Peter, and what are the big takeaway messages for you?
So first, I have to commend Kara and her team on doing just a fabulous job. We report to the Congress every year on the state of healthcare quality and the state of healthcare disparities at a national level. And having worked on a number of press releases and ways to distill complicated information, you hit it out of the park. So I think that's incredibly important. I think this report also goes one step beyond ours, A, because it's based at the state level, where there's a lot of activity and policy levers that could have a very positive impact. And to be honest, national reports, of course, we think are wonderful. But, you know, it's easy to distance yourself from them. Well, that's not us. That's those people in other states dragging the average down. We're doing fine. When it's your state and when you can even bring it down one step further to a county or local community, suddenly you actually have to confront that information. And it's not so easy. All of you in this audience, I would guess, come to appreciate data and all these numbers flying by at different levels of interest. Some of you breathe it. Some of you are thinking, not one more chart. I've had enough. But at the end, it's incredibly helpful because it gives us a sense of where we can go next. And I think Kara did a terrific job explaining our problem. We know nationally and from this report that there's a gap, a big gap, particularly for women, between best possible health care quality and that which is routinely delivered, period, for everyone, a great unifier. But that gap is much larger still for women of color, for women who are poor, less well-educated, and so forth. And I think that this report gives us a chance to look both at the determinants of health, because they're critically important, as well as what's going on in the healthcare system. So I just think this is incredibly powerful. It doesn't give solutions, but it is like having a GPS in your car. It is really important for you to be able to understand where do we need to target our efforts.
Kara, you mentioned a few times in your opening remarks the challenges of collecting all of this data. What made it so hard? Where to begin, right?
Where to begin? I think, you know, some of the challenges that we have, and these are not new to the people in the disparities field, is first of all, we had challenges around language. Are we talking about health disparities? Are we talking about health inequities? Are we talking about health inequalities? Are we talking about Black women? Are we talking about African American women? What are the indicators that we feel should be included in this report? I think it would have been great to include something regarding, you know, domestic violence, but where do we get that data? Looking at the state level for women of color across each of the different racial and ethnic groups. So initially we had started off and we wanted to really just stick to the behavioral risk factor surveillance system and the CPS. But we found as we went forward that we were extremely limited in just those two data sources because indicators such as new AIDS cases, the cancer mortality, which we thought were very important for women's health, weren't part of those data sources. Also, the measure with regards to serious psychological distress was something that was very important to have with regards to women because we know women do experience higher rates of mental illness compared to men, but again, not in that data set. So then looking around to find where we could get that data, that most of the data that we used is publicly available and you don't have to pay for it with the exception of the area resource file. But even with that, because of privacy regulations and things like that, we had difficulty getting some of the data. And we are, again, very grateful to the folks at SAMHSA who ran that data for us for the serious psychological distress so that we could add that piece about mental health for women.
Go ahead.
Just one point about the data as well, and I think Kara's final comments underscored this a bit. Most data sets have a time lag, so I would guess that most of the data in this report predate this economic crisis that now is part of the fabric of our lives, which means that in essence we're always a little bit behind the curve, and when there's a sudden environmental change like the economy, you can bet that in many aspects of this things are actually worse.
That's a good thing to keep in mind. Peter, you bring to us the perspective of a state legislator. So what jumps out at you from this report?
Well, firstly, to Kaiser and for everyone that's in this room, thank you, because this is really critical work. I think when we think about sort of the presentation of this study and we think about the work that we do both on the federal and the state level, we have to think of it in two different ways. One is an intellectual discussion and one is an emotional discussion. And I think while, you know, this study, we can't drive policy without data. I mean, I'm a big believer in data. Anecdotally, we've always known that there are disparities. Anecdotally, I've always known about there were problems with childhood obesity. Anecdotally, I've always known there were issues with regard to trans fat and so many other issues. But until there are those studies that come out that document it, I can't really move forward because everyone will ask, you know, what's the problem? And I can't really tell them. Everyone knows, but you can't define it in a quantitative way. And so it's really important that we have this in order to focus. But on the other side, you know, you can't love this. You can't feel for this document here. But you can feel for those women that were presented in the video. And, Jackie, I've got to commend you. I know that you were sort of restrained and you were dealing more with sort of women, immigrant women, and it's really not about only that sector of women that we're speaking about. And I know that was part of your frustration putting this together in Kaiser's. So we have to remember that this is not the only women we're speaking about. But I felt for those women. I'm damn depressed after watching that video.
Sorry.
Because it touches you. When they're speaking about these issues, I mean, I can read about it and hear, but until you see someone speaking about it and you can see the look on their face, and particularly women. I mean, you know, the woman that was speaking about, you know, she felt guilty for her children. Men might have said, I feel guilty because I wanted my big screen TV. But this emotion, sorry, I'm a man, I can say that. None of the other panelists can say that right now. But I think that it's really important to realize that women suffer a great deal on behalf of their families, and this really brings that through. And so I think it's really important as we go through policy changes, both on the federal and the state level, we consider our quantitative data, but we not forget the sort of faces and the stories of those that are actually within this sort of document.
You've had a really interesting legislative history regarding the issue we're discussing today. So I'm wondering, how did you persuade other lawmakers in the House to establish the commission that looked into these very issues?
That was actually with great difficulty, I've got to be honest with you. I had a staff person, African-American, interested in health care, and he was the person that sort of got me interested in this issue area. And to be quite honest with you, once he drew my attention to this, I realized, I was just very compelled because there was a vulnerable community. It wasn't just women, it was people of color, and it's just something that I felt for because I know that there weren't a lot of people kind of standing up and addressing this issue. So I became very involved, and at that time we had a strong, iron-fisted, I could say dictatorial, he's no longer speaker, but he's a very strong speaker, and he was always concerned about the fiscal place of Massachusetts. And so I actually came up with the idea during a budget session to present a commission to study. We called it health care disparities back then. This is interesting. Just even a year later, by the time we started, we changed it to health disparities, not health care disparities, because we realized it was a lot more. And interesting how you learn. And so I presented it to him, and he said no. And I walked away. I kind of thought about it, and I kind of went up to him again on the rostrum. And he said no again, and I think I went up the third time. And by the third or fourth time, I think, as I continued to speak with him, he changed some of the makeup of the commission to cut out some of the wacky groups he thought where he didn't really want to be part of it because he didn't trust them. And at that point, then we were able to move this, and we started this commission. Now, part of the reason, though, is what we have to be careful of as we're moving forward on policy now is that he didn't want to open up the onion. He was concerned, we're going to open this up, we're going to find everything's going to cost money. And granted, a lot of it is resources, but there are a lot of things you can do that aren't necessarily always about the money. And so that was really the first fear, I think, of him then, and I think, to be quite honest with you, of people now, particularly in California, as California's having so much difficulty, is you don't even want to open that box because you're afraid of what you're going to see and what you will then have to be responsible for paying for to some degree.
Okay, thank you. Cindy, want to turn to you. One of the striking findings in the report, as Kara noted, was the dire circumstances in some cases of American Indian women. The Dakotas ended up in one of those quadrants that was not a good quadrant to appear in of Kara's. Fill out the picture for us of what their circumstances are.
Well, do you have about a week or two? It's difficult to, in a few minutes, to describe what is in this report specific to American Indian, Alaska Native, and not only our women, but our families and communities at large. I want to preface my comments by saying this is phenomenal work. And as a Dakota woman, I want to personally thank the Kaiser Family Foundation and the researchers for having the foresight, the fortitude, and the bravery to do this. And it's a moment in time for me personally as an educator and as a healthcare advocate that I think it's going to make a difference. And I have to believe that things such as this do make a difference. Although as a Dakota woman and a former health director planner for my tribe and community, we're so far behind. It has not gotten better. I returned home to the reservation 6 years ago to become president of my college, my tribal college. And I got invited to a meeting on suicides on my reservation. And I think this is one of the social determinants on the mental health indicator. And it's still a serious issue happening across Indian country and in North Dakota. And so I'm in this meeting, an interagency work group, and it was like deja vu from 20 years, 25 years ago when I was the health director. And I'm like, okay, same room, a few different people, same topic, and it's still happening. And you look at this information, this data overall, and it's still happening. And being Indian is very difficult and complex and very misunderstood, unfortunately. And one of the things I'd like to bring to the table is that it's all our responsibility to push this information forward. We have to do this in a more united fashion. It's not just African American women, Latino women, American Indian women. And to another degree, we need our male colleagues at the table with us to bring this forward, that this is an American issue, and it's unique to America. And it's so sad and so unfortunate, given this country and its leadership role in the world and the day and age that we live in. Most states are having deficit issues. North Dakota is in a boom time. If you don't know, we're sitting on a $1 billion surplus, and it's due to the economics of the energy boom that's happening with the oil drilling and all that. There's no discussion with the American Indian people in my state about things such as health disparity, about things such as the high unemployment rates on the reservations, about the high school dropout rates on the reservations, and yet the state of North Dakota is out recruiting for workers across the country and not on the reservations in the state of North Dakota. So my plea is that this is such good work, and it's reflective of states, and there's responsibility all over, at the federal level, at the state level, at the tribal level, at the community level, at the personal level. And we have to remember the intellectual and the emotional things that this is about and bring all that together. And I speak to you that way as a Dakota woman because it's a holistic concept, and it's culturally who we are and how we think and view the world. But it's also very humanistic, and it also makes sense for all of us. And so it's a profound moment in time when Kaiser Family Foundation is bringing us all together, the academics, the research, the health people, the federal agencies, the legislators that we need. We have to do this together, and we have to do it now. And it is a crisis. It has not gone away. And this just brings it to light. It puts it into perspective in a good way.
Thank you. Carolyn, your agency has been working for years to research disparities and to come up with strategies to eliminate them. What are the big federal strategies?
So I think I would be inaccurate to say that we've got a whole toolbox. But part of the issue is that we recognize, as this report shows very, very clearly, that the challenges are very different locally. Mm-hmm. So what's going on in my county in Maryland with a dramatic increase in the proportion of Latinos in the county probably looks different than some parts of California, because the people came from different places. The people in California in many instances have been here longer and so forth. So you would expect the strategies that we're going to need to improve quality and reduce disparities are going to need to be tailored to the population at hand. One area where we've been very excited has been actually trying to get federal resources in community services and public health along with health care to work together. And this was a project that we focused on Hispanic elders for the past several years with the Area Agencies on Aging. Now, you don't necessarily think of them as health agencies. They're really not. But you know what they are in terms of helping people change their health behaviors and so forth? They are, to use a military term, boots on the ground. I mean, because they know people in the communities and neighborhoods. So our agency could give these 9 metropolitan areas with a very high proportion of Latino elders. We focused on prevention and diabetes. We gave them good data so that they would know the specific parts of the community where they really needed to reach out. Between local public health resources, the agencies on aging, and so forth, we've begun to change how people think about managing diabetes, which is a huge problem across America, and particularly for people of color, with much more of a focus on how patients can be effective partners in their care. So that's been one kind of strategy, but it's still very much a work in progress. Let me say this, though, as someone who runs a research agency, we don't have the luxury to do studies and tell you that then we will come up with solutions. We definitely need to learn as we go. So we've worked with health plans. We're doing some work now to make it easier to collect data in a consistent way on a voluntary basis from individuals so that healthcare organizations can know how they're doing, because absent that, they don't necessarily see the problem.
And it, Peter, as Carolyn rightly points out, one size does not fit all. And so what is incumbent on the states themselves to initiate?
You need to have some interested participants in the state. I mean, that's really what it's about, is to challenge people to become engaged in the process. Now, I told you about my one colleague that got me involved in this issue. I can still think of the one person that got me involved on the issue of childhood obesity, the one person that got me involved on the issue of suicide prevention, the one person that got me involved on, you know, a myriad of issues that, to be quite honest with you, sometimes, and I don't say this to blow my own horn, I'm just either the only male in the room, the only white male in the room, or just, you know, sometimes one of the only people in the room completely. Now, a lot of these issues have changed. I mean, I remember when we started the issue of minority health disparities, I'd be one of the only white men, or the only white folks in the room. And that's all changed now. You know, we've just had a couple of recent events where it's widely a greater diversity of the crowd. So this has changed. But I think it's kind of connecting, and I think it's more on the emotional level with the quantitative data back there, with some of the people that you think might make that difference. And if you don't, sometimes I'll be the first one to say, I'm not going to call my congressman. What does he care what I have to say? I'm just a state rep. I'll be the first one to fall guilty of this, but I'm also the first one to tell people that you've got that power to make that difference by connecting with someone and engaging them and then getting them and or others to be part of this. And I have sort of some thoughts more about the way that you can make policy, which we can speak at a later point, which can be helpful in kind of achieving some of the successes that I think each state can have and then the nation can have as well.
So we've talked about the federal level, the state level. I'd like to turn back to you, Beth, for the local level, not only at the community level, but at the city level. What initiatives can you try to drive, and what can't you do?
Well, let me start with what we can do, and actually what we have done. You know, I just want to say, you know, I've been working in the community level for almost 15 years now, and I've been working on disparities on a number of different issues, particularly with women. And this report is extraordinary. And I just want to share, the comments of my colleagues up here just to say this is such a wealth of information. Where has this been? You know, it's so wonderful to have this at our fingertips at this point. But, you know, the district popped out to me in this report as really having some of the worse than average scores for a number of different indicators, but then also with a number of different dimensions. And where we didn't score worse than average was really about the access. And that, I think, is where the district, from a policy level, and really started from community advocates and service providers that worked with the city council to create, you know, to increase the Medicaid eligibility, to create the DC Alliance plan. And so we've really worked very hard to reduce that uninsured rate, and that's reflected here. It's reflected in terms of that our utilization of healthcare resources have actually gone up. So that's a tremendous difference, and this has really been within the last 5 to 6 years that this has happened. So, you know, it's going to be very interesting as we sort of watch these trends to see where it needs to go. I think our challenges are looking at some of the determinants. The city is a segregated city. The majority of African American women and now Latino women live in what are considered underserved areas of the city. So we have to somehow begin to break that mold, if you will. And I think that there's some other initiatives, a chronic care initiative in particular, that again the District of Columbia is taking on right now, that's going to start to put medical centers and increase primary care providers and medical residents into some of these areas to at least get, you know, the health care into the communities where it needs to be, so that we can, where I sit, I can then make that linkage. So if I can make a linkage with a primary care provider, then we're going to really start to increase these screening rates and ideally start to bring down the mortality rate for breast cancer for African American women in particular.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up now to questions from the audience. I will ask you to stand so our online audience can see you as well as hear you, to identify yourself, and if you're here with an organization, to let us know your affiliation. The gentleman. We'll start with the gentleman.
I don't know if this is a guy thing, but I'm depressed as well. yesterday, the White House, the administration rolled out the health disparities white paper. It's literally almost a white paper. And there's only one reference, almost the last paragraph, to women's health disparities. So I strongly encourage you to get this report into the administration as soon as possible. We also had a conversation at the White House with the Secretary of Health around disparities, and that I recall, only one person talked about women's health disparities specifically. So you're not at the table, and I encourage you to do that.
Yep.
You bring out a really, it's good to see someone else is as emotional as I am about this, by the way, sir. You know, I think that's a really important point. You have to have people at the table. And if you don't have people at the table, then you have to remember that there are people out there that either should be at the table or at least you can represent at the table. In Massachusetts, it's easy to forget. When we were having a lot of these meetings, we had a lot of Latinos and African-American folks, but we didn't have many Asian folks. We didn't have, you know, we didn't have many Indian or Pakistani folks, part of the Asian community. We didn't have really any American Indians at the table. And we weren't thinking in the terms of women breaking down further. So sometimes we'll be thinking in terms of women having worse health outcomes, particularly during Go Red for Women month and women suffering greater cardiac problems. But we don't sort of then take it that next level and break it down as to minority. And so even now, just yesterday, there was a hearing on a bill that I presented to have people with developmental disabilities also be sort of part of this minority that's sometimes not dealt with appropriately in healthcare. So I think and I say this all the time, we have to remember those groups that aren't at the table, either to get them to the table or just to remember that they're out there, because it's very easy to forget when we're speaking about issues affecting Latino Americans or Black Americans, and we're forgetting about the myriad of complex issues that deal with Asian Americans. I mean, you know, I did a healthcare hearing on Asian Americans with Dr. Howard Koh over at Harvard, and it wasn't because I realized I just thought it was part of it. It was probably out of my own ignorance at the very beginning when I started this process. I just, well, we should do something on Asian Americans. Had I been involved in this, I might have not done that, but I did it, and it was amazing, the complexity of the different groups in there. It was, you know, it was Japanese and Chinese and Korean, you know, it got into the Southeast Asian, and then it got into Hmong, you know. I mean, I'd never heard of Hmong before and then realized there's this tribe that has even more complex diversity problems and health problems that weren't. And then the waves of immigration. When did people come to this country is another sort of complication of this. And so within the Asian American community, there really has been no representation at any of these meetings. And so it's incumbent upon all of us to sort of remember those that aren't there, either to get them to the table or to remember that they're there to continue them to be part of the discussion. Otherwise, they'll be forgotten. We'll move on. And the disparities not only will exist, they'll be driven further apart because of our failure to remember some of these folks or to have them at the table. I think it's really important that we remember that.
Cindy, what strategies have you seen at the community level that helps the American Indian's voice get a seat at the table, get a hearing at the table?
Women activists. And I think in general, overall, when you see some of the services and programs in the community, at least where I come from, they've generally been initiated by women, you know, and obviously we have a vested stake relative to our own personal health and well-being. But because we're so family-orientated, which I think everyone is. And so if you can mobilize a group of women around a particular topic or issue, but then you also have to teach the political process. And who are you going up against at which level? Is it very community-orientated? So is it the county commission? Is it the tribal government? Is it state legislature? Is it Congress? I mean, is it at the national level? And which level? And then how do you fight those respective battles? And so it's giving people the tools to understand the processes, but even at such a personal level, how it's going to impact me or affect me.
A question on this side. Again, if you can identify yourself and your affiliation.
Yes, Willarda Edwards. I'm a practicing internist in Baltimore and also the president-elect of the National Medical Association. And I'm particularly interested in Ms. Clancy in what you said about community health advocates. because we emphasize very much the need to do more in terms of prevention. We know that we're working, that the President and Congress is working very diligently on health care reform. And in that health care reform, we know that there's the concern about primary care and also about preventive measures. I think that as a practicing internist, that it's very important to also have prevention as part of our emphasis, and the fact that there's in this current healthcare system a need to have someone that can advocate for you. And I think that having more people that are involved in the community that can reach out and help people to navigate the system until we reform it, it would be a very good thing for us to do. And I wondered if you might comment further on what your organization is doing with that.
Thank you so much. First, we're incredibly excited, as I can tell you are, about the probability of health care reform this year. But I see that as just a starting point. That is the that creates a framework where everyone can get access to health care, and that's a terrific thing, as we've seen in Massachusetts. However, the conversation about the connections we need between community resources, community activism, and clinical care delivery, I think, is one that's in its infancy, if that advanced. If you look at what is killing us, and there's lots of reports on this, it's chronic illness care, right? The 20% of people who incur about 72% of Medicare costs are people with multiple chronic illnesses. We don't do a very good job. We've been doing a lot of quality reporting. You can click on the web and see lots of report cards for health plans and so forth. And what we see is interesting. Stuff, activities that are under the direct control of a clinician or organization, we're doing a whole lot better. So that's, we order the right tests and so on and so forth for managing chronic illness. When you actually look at the outcomes, how well are people's cardiac risk factors controlled, diabetes and so forth, we're not doing so great. I mean, 60% is about the ballpark. Now, these are folks with insurance. These are folks who can get access to care. Some of them can even email their doctors. They can certainly call somebody 24 hours a day. 60% are achieving reasonable control. And that's very much because that has nothing to do with what goes on in a clinician's office. This is all about how you live with the illness, which is what we saw in the community-based project I was starting to describe. So I'm hoping that we see more and more of this. I'm hoping that this report, because it makes many factors of health and health care visible that are sometimes invisible to us depending on where we live, that it's a prompt for a conversation, why can't we do that? There's a lot of why questions here, but what's really going to change things is saying, why not? Why can't we do a better job?
Well, I want to continue this conversation about the healthcare reform that Congress is now debating. Beth, even though you operate at a community level, you live in the nation's capital, what opportunities do you see at this moment in time for the issues of disparity to be addressed in the context of the healthcare reform debate?
I mean, I think if now's not the time, then the question is, when is the time? I mean, this is, I think we're very primed at this particular point to really begin to dive into the hard issues because of, quite frankly, the uninsured rate in the country. And you know, to come back to the point of navigation for a second, I think that is essential. Capital Breast Care Center was established just 4 years ago. We screen over 2,000 women, most of whom do not have any health insurance for breast cancer. And the navigation aspect that we use both to navigate women into our center for screening and then to navigate them if they need diagnostic cares and follow-up is essential. The healthcare system, even when you have the best insurance, is extraordinarily complicated. If you have limited insurance or no insurance, your options end. There's a dead end there. And so our navigators are able to navigate the women through the system. We have agreements set up with other service providers so it makes it an easier access. But you have got to have a health advocate on the other end to really help understand, you know, how you can get from point A to point B to point C within the healthcare system. So, you know, I think we're at a very, very critical time now, and there's so much that's being reviewed and so much that's being discussed and, you know, so much data that's now on the table. And I think we also need to bring in those community models and look at what is working. What is working in urban areas? What are the models that are working in the rural areas? What are the models that are working in that suburban setting to really begin to address, you know, what is going to be the right set of reform. And I think it's not going to just end with whatever happens this year. It's going to be an evolving discussion that's going to, you know, I think take many, many stages as we go along.
A question in the back.
Hi, my name is Anya Van Berkler. I'm a clinical scholar in the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program at the University of Pennsylvania. And my question is principally for Dr. James. I was really struck by the graph with the four quadrants, and particularly by quadrant one in the upper left, where the minorities were having more disparities, where the majority was doing better. And I wonder if you can speculate on what you think is driving that. I know it's you don't necessarily have all the data, but you may have thoughts. Thank you.
Well, I think many of the things that we've heard discussed here already, and this report did not look at trends, and we have yet to sort of look at the implications and the policy relationship to some of the policy variables and the outcomes that we've seen. But I think that when we look at that right quadrant, the left quadrant, that one of the things that struck me, I thought you were going to go with that, is, you know, of course, the district sitting up there by itself in the top corner. And that is in part because, you know, my white women in the district tend to be, on average, healthier, wealthier, and better educated than the white women, than the women of color in the district, who are, you know, largely African American and living in Ward 7 and 8, which Beth is serving. I think as far as, you know, what's driving some of those, it really is a host of factors. And that's part of the reason we have the access piece, as well as the social determinants piece, as well as the policy piece, because all of those factors come together to result in the health outcomes that we've seen in that first section. So I couldn't really speculate on one particular driving force.
Is there a question on this side of the audience?
Yes,
right here. Wait for the mic to come to you.
My name is Carla Shepherd Rubinger. I'm the executive director of the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine. And as someone with a research background, I am in awe of what you have put together here. But also as someone with a research background, I really have always wondered how we can ever track prevention. It's the hardest thing to prove, and I believe it is the most necessary piece that's totally neglected in the discussion, in the regulations, in the policy aspects of what has to be done. How do we find it, and what do we do about it?
Carolyn?
So we can count some aspects of prevention, other things we're not very good at, or we count them in ways that are fairly superficial, and it's hard to know. For example, there are quality measures that hospitals check to say, we counseled somebody about smoking. It's hard to know from that check whether this was a meaningful conversation or a don't forget to stop smoking, see you later. Well, there's a lot of that that goes on. So there's some science in trying to figure out how to do that more accurately. What I can tell you in a very positive way is that this is a very strong focus of the administration. Prevention was a big part of the Recovery Act. And it has been something that then-Senator and now President Obama has been very, very focused on. So I think that we will see a much stronger focus on prevention. That said, I think we're still going to need these strong connections between the community and what goes on in clinical care to make this real for lots and lots of people. And frankly, we have to figure out a way to get individuals more engaged on their own as well. Once access barriers are removed, I think that becomes a very different conversation, because absent that, you're asking people to sign up for another headache, as the one woman said, which I thought was perfect description.
Thank you. Thank you all. I'd now like to turn the program over to Marcia Lilly Blanton, who is a senior advisor here at the Foundation, a co-author, and one of the godmothers of this report. Thank you.
That's a good way of putting it. On behalf of the Foundation, let me first thank all of you who have taken the time to come to today's briefing. I want to especially add my words of thanks to our National Advisory Committee that helped guide us in producing this report, and certainly I want to thank our panelists for helping to share your insights on the challenges and the opportunities we face in addressing health disparities among women. Today's briefing is about women, but the picture we are painting includes more than women. This report, Putting Women's Healthcare Disparities on the Map, is about families and about communities, which we've heard from several of our panelists. It's about the children in those families and communities. And it's about the men who have connection to those families, either because they have fathered or parenting the children, or they are the uncles and the grandfathers in the families. All have a stake. Let me say that again. All have a stake in how we address the disparities that are identified in this report. Whether we're talking about disparities in poverty rates, disparities in health indicators, or disparities in access, all have a stake. We've talked a lot today about the problems or the challenges, however you frame it. It's important, though, to be mindful that a handful of states all performed better than average, and by that we mean had smaller disparities than the average for the nation across all three dimensions. And another 13 states performed better than average on two of the three dimensions. This does not say that better than average is the gold standard. It is not. But it is a place to start as a goal. The states doing better than average give us confidence in what is achievable now, in what is achievable now with current knowledge and technologies in this nation. Now, let me digress for a little while. In the field of education, there have been sustained and visible efforts to close what's called the achievement gap or the education gap. Some of those efforts have even focused on what we call structural factors, such as highly segregated schools and neighborhoods that actually impede or interfere with performance. In health, I am still amazed by survey data that show a sizable share of the general public and health providers don't even believe that racial disparities in health are real. And among those who do believe the gaps are real, efforts to close the gap are modest for many different reasons. So in health, we have a lot of work to do. There are many reasons given for why there are so little action and efforts on these issues. Among the reasons given is that we sometimes have a lack of evidence on the nature of the problem, and we also sometimes have a lack of evidence on what will make a difference. The report released today provides data and information that can help states and local communities with the first issue, to better identify the specific challenges they face. As Dr. Clancy said, it's very easy to look at national data and say, that's not me. But when you're looking at state data, you have to say and question, what is it we are not doing? What is it we could do better? The next phase of this project, as Kara mentioned, is to undertake analyses that can answer questions about the extent to which state-level healthcare payment and workforce variables, some of the policy variables, are related to disparities in health and healthcare. That information will help with the second question that's often raised, or the second issue that's often raised as an excuse for why we aren't doing more. In closing, it is well recognized that the disparities detailed in this report reflect long-standing societal inequalities and obstacles to better health, some of which will require federal attention. However, there are a number of state-level policies and healthcare delivery issues that shape opportunities for health and access to care. The report findings show the importance of looking beyond our national statistics and gaining a better of understanding at the state level of where challenges and opportunities to eliminate racial and ethnic disparities exist. As discussions about healthcare reform intensify, investments that can improve the life chances of women of color can have a ripple effect on their children, on our families, and, of course, on the health of the nation overall. I look forward to working with all of you as we use the information in this report to work toward a society in which health and access to health care are not defined by the racial, the economic, or the geographic divides in our nation. Thank you again for coming to today's briefing.